the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest today on the program is Mr. Ron Greenwald. He is going to discuss the subject of, it may not be popular, but it's elder abuse and its potential, especially given larger number of siblings, becomes an important issue. So we're going to look at what causes it and how to prevent it, how to deal with it. You know, several weeks ago on the program, we did a show on prepping for retirement. So you think you can retire? Think again was the subject of that, because a lot of people are moving along with assumptions they may have made when they made plans some time back. But guess what? World conditions have changed. We got a lot of response from that program. It raised a lot of questions with listeners who were concerned about that. So today what we're going to do is to pick up on that very same theme, and we'll raise even more questions to get you thinking on this subject. We're going to reverse engineer retirement. I wonder if I could reverse engineer life, you know, like you're born old and you get younger and younger.
Yeah, go back to your youth. Wouldn't that be great?
Well, no. But we don't want to talk about that right here. Anyway, well, what we're going to do is look realistically about whether or not your notion of retirement can actually become a reality. In essence, it's a financial physical is what it is. Whether you're in the financial shape to retire, can you get in the financial shape to retire? What you have to do that? It's an important number, you know, the one you need to know whether you are in physical shape to retire or not. So how are we going to do this? Let's start with a backgrounder, Jim, on this whole thing.
If you take a look at what is primarily done in retirement planning today, you look at the future. You say, you know, you have a goal of wanting to retire. You may have a year. Hey, I want to retire in the year 2020. Or maybe you have a particular age. I'm going to retire at age 62, 65, whatever that is. And I also want to have X amount of dollars of income, a lifestyle that you want to enjoy. Now, all of that's good to know. But in business, it's called, what's my number? What is that number that you're going to need? What is the amount of assets you're going to have the day you retire to make all this happen? But there's another number, John, that I think that's more important. It's not about the future. It's really about where you stand today. This number is actually more relevant to your future retirement plans and your retirement goals, because really, it's an honest assessment of where you stand today. How much assets you should have today, I mean right now, not how much you're going to have in the future. And it's a more realistic assessment of your chances of reaching your goals, or if right now you need to take corrective action. So most retirement plans kind of, you know, look into the future and they're saying, okay, you're going to retire at age 66. That's going to be the year 2020, and you need to have this amount of assets to produce this income. A more realistic approach is, all right, given the fact that you want to retire, let's say 10 years from now with X amount of dollars, how much do you have right now? And given how much you have right now, is that plan to retire in 2020 really realistic? It's kind of like walking into the doctor and saying, hey, I want to go do a bunch of things. I'm going to go run a marathon. Your doctor might say, well, let's take a look at you and see if you're in shape to run a marathon. And that's really, John, looking at today rather than the future, which is a different form of thinking when you look at your retirement goals.
All right. So I have this number here. What does this number tell me? And if I get the number and I know what it's telling me, then the next question is, so what? I mean, what do I do with it? I would imagine that realistically, it could trigger a whole series of other issues. And there are two feelings you might have. One is you actually feel that you're actually on track, or there's always that sinking like feeling like, I can't do this. We've got a problem.
Well, when you do this kind of analysis, it's going to tell us exactly that. You're on track to meet your goals. And are those goals realistic, or are they unrealistic? You know, a lot of us would like to retire early. A lot of people like to retire with a certain amount of income, and they want a certain kind of lifestyle. But given where they are today with the assets that they have, what they're saving, and what their expectations are, John, that may be totally unrealistic. So it really is basically saying, hey, yes, you are on track to reach those goals, or the other side of it, no, you aren't. That's just not realistic.
Well, then there's that moment of disillusion when you point out to the client, say, for example, that the goals are unrealistic. That's a disillusionary moment. How does the client usually react to that? Is it hopelessness or, oh my gosh, what are we going to do?
The number could indicate you have a problem. And the good thing about that, it's like going to a doctor and he says, hey, you have high cholesterol. You know, maybe you don't have heart disease yet, but what you can do is take some corrective action. And usually if the number says, hey, this isn't going to work, there's really three choices or paths that you can look at. Sometimes it may be a combination of those paths. I mean, the first option, obviously, is, hey, you wanted to retire at age 62. That's just not going to happen. You just don't have the assets. You don't have the income that you think you're going to need. So the first option is really to delay that retirement date. So instead of age 62, maybe you delay it to age 66. Many cases, John, this can solve the problem just by doing that. And we'll see that when we demonstrate that in today's case study. But by delaying retirement, it does a couple of things. You have fewer years that you're going to be drawing down on assets. Number two, you have more years to accumulate assets if you're saving. You can take advantage of Social Security options. That can produce a higher Social Security income when you begin to draw on it. And in some cases, it's, you know, Social Security is really the only dependable pension income that you have.
Dependable so far, I might point out, by the way, given that fateful day when government recognizes that it can't keep all of its promises. You know, and we're already seeing a lot of that, too, by the way, in retirement statistics, because the baby boomers are already working longer. That's something that's important. And they push back the full retirement age by 1 to 2 years, of course, depending on when you're born. That's been staggered based on birth dates. What are other options, though?
I mean, this is sort of related to the first option. They're sort of one and the same. The first one, as we mentioned, is to delay retirement. Another one that we're seeing more and more today, and actually it's productive, it can help you live longer, keep you active, is working part-time, which can blend in well with your retirement plans. There was a study last week in the Wall Street Journal that talked about people that either work part-time or actually work longer, live longer, and have more active lives. So let's just call this semi-retirement as an option, along with, let's say, option one to delay retirement. The other one fitting in with this is semi-retire. So you don't fully retire. Maybe you're working part-time.
Well, there's always my second option, which I really like, and that's win the lottery. You know, I call it my retirement investment certificate. The big bucks
and
never seem to come.
What are the odds of that happening?
Yeah, I've won a couple of bucks so far, but that's not very good. Third option is inheritance. You know, if you know you're getting extra money from your parents that possibly you could invest to use for your retirement, that might be a possibility.
Well, certainly. I mean, if you got a windfall or an inheritance, that can change a lot of plans. But usually the second option, in many cases, you know, the first option was to delay retirement or to semi-retire. The second option is probably my least favorite. It involves getting more aggressive on investments. Maybe you have the wrong investment portfolio or the wrong investment allocation. And sometimes you see this mistake, and it's been made a lot since the financial crisis of 2009, where investors are getting into more risky investments. I saw this after 2009 with a lot of people putting a lot of their money into the gold market. We did get a run-up of gold for 2 years, but you know, it was all predicated on the fact the crisis began in the U.S., the dollar was going to collapse, and of course, we've known that's not what happened. It's just the opposite. The dollar is hitting new records, strongest currency. We talked about that on last weekend's show. But trying to get higher returns, usually at a late stage prior to retirement, they may be totally inappropriate. So, but a second option is to change the investment allocation to be more in alignment with your retirement goals. And we'll get into what are realistic options regarding that.
Well, when would that be a logical choice anyway? I mean, think of a situation where the client, say, for example, has the wrong assets. Real classic one nowadays is they're in cash or in bond funds or something like that. We've talked about that quite a bit in this 0% interest environment. That's where they are. And one gentleman who's doing just that, I always like these gym locker room conversations. You can usually strike them up with the guys there. He said, well, I've got some in stocks and I've got a whole bunch over here. And I said, well, you realize you're losing money. And he said to me, well, I can sleep at night. Now, now to me, you know, because to him, the fact that the digits were the same, even if they didn't go up very much, his quote, money was still there, but his buying power stacked up against inflation, which as we discussed on Financial Sense last week, the inflation's still going up, even though it's somewhat concealed in the official figures. So he's actually losing money. And as we've discussed here, and it's very well documented in the financial press, as a result of the Great Recession, the major hiccup that we went through in the latter part of the first decade, this scared a lot of investors into making very, very poor investment decisions, like the one I just described right there. Too much money in one asset class or in things that are actually losing value as you hold them, cash, bonds, and lately, gold. Remember, we were very bullish on gold in the first decade, but now we've said the market in that has shifted. And this is a situation, though, that we often encounter frequently among listeners to the program, or if you go to other websites, Jim, you know, people are keep investing in gold or silver and hoping that ship will come in as far as an investment rather than a hedge against inflation.
Yeah, we see this probably a lot more often today where after the financial crisis, as you mentioned, investors really shifted all into one asset class. And usually you see this, it was in cash or maybe they went into bond funds. I read a study last year, it was done by Lipper Services. Since 2009 bull market began, net inflows into stock funds was only $41 billion compared to over $1 trillion into bond funds. We see a lot of people that went into gold, especially when gold ran up close to a little over 1900, silver was up to 50, on this basic assumption, which is sold a lot by the gloom and doom crowd, which is the dollar was going to collapse. And so, gosh, if it's going to collapse, we're going to have another financial crisis. I'm going to be all in gold. And we encounter that frequently. And unfortunately, what it really involves when you look at this second option of changing investment choices, it's really an education process. It's helping the client deal with their fears. And we discussed that in a similar case last week with Bill and Jan Smith. Bill retired back in 2006, put all his money into stock funds, rolled his 401k into an IRA, lost about 30% of that in the financial crisis, went into cash. Then he went with a well-known advisor predicting a dollar crash, went into precious metals and foreign stocks and lost another 10%. So instead of a crash, we got a dollar bull market and stocks went up as well. And precious metals, as everyone knows, went into a bear market. So he lost more money and basically he went into cash for a couple of years. Unfortunately, he was drawing down a lot of his principal to meet his living expenses when his wife retired. So it's really a long process. It involves compromises. It involves a lot of education, and also it involves developing a plan, showing how different asset classes, whether it's bonds, stocks, maybe an annuity. In the case of Bill and Jan Smith, we use bonds, annuity, and stocks to solve the problem. But you have to reach a balance between both spouses that they're both comfortable, but it's a more difficult choice to make when it comes to investments. A lot of people, John, are just simply frightened. They read the wrong stuff and they don't have a plan, which is, I think, one of the reasons why they stay in that frightened state.
Well, there's one final option, it would seem. That would be to delay retirement and perhaps work part-time. So you say, I'm really tired of this nonsense all day long, but I don't want to really get out of it. So I'll work on it for just a few hours a day or something like that. The second would be some kind of change in investment strategy. Third option, have I missed something here?
No, I mean, the third option is actually to save more, put more aside. Sometimes it's possible, John, by downsizing, as you'll see in the case we're going to discuss here in just a moment. It could involve maybe the wife going to work if she was a stay-at-home mom. It also involves changing views on college funding, which we see a lot of mistakes made in the 50s by a lot of couples where they spend too much money allocated to education at the expense of their own retirement. Or maybe it's getting more tax-efficient investing, cutting taxes, using those tax savings and freeing up additional dollars for savings.
You know, Jim, a lot of times you've talked about maintaining health, and this is very much analogous to getting a physical. And by the way, you know, a lot of diseases are preventable. I remember getting on one guy's case about his cholesterol, and he says, well, I guess it's a little high, and maybe a blah, blah, blah. A week later, he had a serious heart attack. Now, granted, by that time, he was probably in trouble, but he let this go. And it's the same things for, say, for example, colonoscopies, all the things that can prevent serious diseases that are minimal. And it's the same thing here financially. You know, in a disease area, you find out what's your blood pressure, what's your cholesterol, what's going on elsewhere in your body, any other markers that are important. If you know this, you can actually take simple corrective action that presents the major onset of many, many diseases. So in finances, you get this numero, this number. It tells your clients their financial health based on the number. When you know that, then you can figure out a course correction to put you back on track or somewhat change your expectations. Now, first of all, let's look at how this number is derived. Let's start with that.
Well, here's a great part about it. It's not complicated. It's really an index, and it boils down to an index that really tries to say for every dollar of income you want to have at retirement, how many assets or what kind of assets do you need to have now? It's not based on, let's say, outdated historical data like stock market returns, special calculations or predictions, nor does it make loads of assumptions that may never happen. And that's one of the problems. It's a real-time index that tracks five key data points that are very important to your retirement. The current level of interest rates is the first one. Second is inflation forecast, because think about that. Think if you retired at the late 70s when inflation was rising compared to, let's say, the 80s when it was coming down, or in the last decade, it went up as a result of what was going on in this country with the dollar, inflated assets. Compare that to now, where inflation rates, where, you know, central banks are fighting deflation. So the second part of the index is inflation forecast. Third one is risk adjustments. Fourth, very important, is life expectancy tables. If you're an average person, assume that you have average health. You know, given your age, what is the probability or the lifespan that you're going to live during your retirement years? That's very important, because that's what you're going to have to live off and drawing down on income. And finally, cash flow projections. In other words, things that are knowable. What will be your Social Security if you have a pension? What will pension income be? Given your current level of assets, what does that produce in income? And so it's more realistic. It's documented in real time, and it comes up with an index number. It's a way of looking ahead. It's ahead of everything else you're going to be doing. In fact, you can even reverse engineer it and saying, okay, I want to have X amount of dollars when I retire. Given what I have now, how much do I need to up this, or how much do my assets need to increase by the time I get to retirement? It's what do you need to save? So this is going to get you into those three option modes that we talked about. Either one, as a result of this number either not being a number that we need, you're going to have to take corrective action. Either you delay retirement, or you work part-time, you change your investment strategy, or three, you end up saving more. And saving more can involve either one, a spouse going back to work, cutting expenses, downsizing, a number of things that you can do. But it tells you, John, just like, you know, your friend that had the heart attack, you know, had he maybe gone, got a physical earlier and took it seriously, where his doctor said, hey, you have high blood pressure and you have high cholesterol, you need to take some actions now, and this is what you need to do. You need to change your diet, start exercising, and de-stress so you can avoid this happening. This is what this index does. It really gives you a realistic assessment of really where you stand today in terms of where you're going to be down the road.
Right. It's very much like a physical. It's a retirement index. It measures and assesses the reality of whether or not you can retire if you're not ready for it, or projected will not be ready for it, and diagnosed early, you can take corrective course action and at least correct the problem early enough just to get back on track. But the first thing is you have to know what the track is, and that's where having a plan is important. You shouldn't become part of the state of 70% of Americans who have no plan. So what we're going to do this week is discuss our case study for the week. And of course, these case studies are based in real life events that we have experience with, but the names have been changed to protect the person's involved. So who are our two victims this week?
Well, I wouldn't say victims. This week, we're going to talk about John and Barbara Benson. John was age 62, Barbara age 61. They wanted to retire in the next 2 years, basically John at 64. He had a heart attack at age 58. Currently, he was on medication, changing his diet, exercising, doing all the right things. Obviously, you're going to take some corrective action when something like this happens. That was one of the reasons he wanted to retire early. And based on their financial situation, when we gathered all the information, got the index number, we basically had to say, John, you know what? You don't have the assets to retire when you want to. And that was the cold reality of it. I think they sort of suspected that when they came in, given where their situation was. But that was the first result of the plan is, hey, we got to take something. We have to do something different here because you simply don't have the numbers and don't have the assets to retire when you want to.
Well, I assume the issue here then was not enough assets, too much debt, and no pensions, all of those things combined.
There were several issues here, and I think this is one a lot of our listeners are going to relate to. Well, number one, they didn't have enough assets, and there was a reason for that. They spent the last decade in their 50s spending a lot of money towards their children's education. We see this a lot with parents. In fact, earlier on in the decade, they took out a second mortgage on their home for $100,000, which they just recently finally paid off. So instead of applying more money towards a 401k, more money towards savings, all of that money went to expensive educations for two of their children. In fact, they went into debt to finance that education and recently just paid off that $100,000 second mortgage. So, you know, that was one of the reasons why they didn't have the assets that they were hoping to have, because so much money went into private education and they put less money towards retirement. In fact, John wasn't fully taking advantage of his 401k program, which was a shame because on the first 6% of his salary, he got 100% match from his employer.
All right, doctor, what was the prognosis and the prescription?
Well, a number of things. First of all, instead of retiring at age 64, the reality was John was going to have to retire at age 66, which was full retirement age. At that time, he would have Social Security income of $28,000. And the plan was to have Barbara take half of John's Social Security, which would be about $14,000. Her Social Security, if she took it, would only be roughly about $12,000. Now, what the plan was, she would take half of his and allow hers to compound to age 70, and then her Social Security would grow to $17,000, which would be $3,000 more a year. Now, a couple of things. We wanted to maximize the 401k plan with matching contributions, especially since the employer matched 100% of the first 6% of his salary. In order to do that, we had to do a number of things. Now, they recently had paid down the mortgage prior to coming to see me. And basically, they had roughly a $900,000 house with $300,000 on mortgage. And that was roughly $1,500 in payments. And so what we needed to do is get rid of the mortgage payment of about $1,500 a month, free up some equity from their home, and we needed to get them in a smaller home. They agreed, you know, the kids had moved out, they didn't need the bigger house, and free up some capital for investment, because really the issue was they didn't have enough assets to live on, and really all they had was 401k and Social Security.
So I'm assuming it worked out. In essence, they went from being victims to victors.
A couple of the obvious things, delaying retirement was one of them. We sold the home and they paid cash. They moved from one city to another home where they paid $450,000 for a home. So it was free and clear. What did that do? That freed up about $1,500 a month in payments, also expenses, property taxes, etc. So what that did is freed up more cash for savings and allowed John to put as much as he could into his 401k program, which was roughly $18,000 a year. His employer would match $6,000 of that, the first 6% of his salary. So in essence, even though John was putting in $18,000, his employer was putting in $6,000. And so in essence, he was saving $24,000 a year. You do that over a four-year period, and John, that's another $100,000 they were going to accumulate in assets, because that was the problem here. We didn't have enough assets. That would increase the asset base as a result of getting rid of the home sale, because that would free up not only additional savings for the 401k program, but also free up some assets that could accumulate in the investment portfolio. The second thing we also did is delayed retirement till age 66, and we were going to maximize Barbara's Social Security by she would end up taking half of John's Social Security and then allow hers to accumulate to age 70. So the result was, given where their 401k program was, John had about $430,000 in his 401k. They had about $70,000 in an IRA. So assuming modest returns on that 401k program, plus an additional savings of $24,000 a year over the next four-year period, they're actually 2 years away from retirement now. We were estimating that 401k with contributions and growth would grow to about $700,000. The IRA would grow to $95,000. And then the $150,000 that was left over after the home sale, that would be roughly about $200,000. So the plan was by age 66, when John would retire, would have close to $1 million worth of assets. So that would produce roughly about $30,000 a year. You add that to $42,000 of Social Security, they would have $72,000 a year of income. But remember, we also reduced their expenses of roughly $80,000 a year by $20,000 by getting rid of the mortgage, a less expensive house, less upkeep, less property taxes. So in this case, it involved a number of things: delaying retirement, increasing savings, and maximizing Social Security, and also cutting expenses by downsizing and paying cash for a home and getting rid of a mortgage deduction.
So the problem was not enough assets, and we corrected that by downsizing and cutting expenses and thus increasing the assets, enabling savings to then increase. And in addition to that, retirement was delayed by 4 years, but ultimately the mission was accomplished because you were able to maximize Social Security benefits as well. By using all of those strategies, you were able to achieve that. So in essence, a job well done once again by applying a number and a plan to retirement. Coming up next, Ron Greenwald, Elder Abuse, Recognizing It, Avoiding It, as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Puflava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
An issue that we often hear in retirement today is elder abuse. What is it? Seniors being taken advantage of by outside unscrupulous promoters, and in some cases, even family members. Joining me on the program is Ron Greenwald. He's a promoter of elder abuse awareness. And Ron, this is something that you never used to hear too much about, or if you did, it was sort of buried. Nobody talked about it. I recently came across a case, an elderly woman, 85 years old, dementia, Alzheimer's. Two of her children had mortgaged her property, took a reverse mortgage, took the money, changed life insurance policies at the expense of the other children and their mother. But this isn't a freak accident. We see more and more of these kind of things happening. Why don't you tell us a little bit about elder abuse? What are its more prominent type of situations that you run across? And then let's talk about how to protect against it.
Well, Jim, I really appreciate you having us on and this opportunity to make people aware of what's going on out there. It's really an epidemic, and it's something that people will sweep under the rug so many times because, as you said in your example, so much of it is within the family that the senior oftentimes feels ashamed, embarrassed to go public with what's happening to them, or, you know, for many reasons, they just don't report it. So it's something that we have to be on the forefront of identifying it, you know, where we can see something happening, that we report it, or we can call Adult Protective Services, or we can talk to a trusted advisor who may have the confidence of that senior to get out in front of it. I mean, the two big ones that we hear about repeatedly is the foreign lottery scam, in terms of where you are asked to wire money in return for a supposed winnings. That is never going to happen. the grandmother I'm in jail scam, where somebody has the grandmother or grandfather's information, gives them a call and pretends to be the grandson or granddaughter caught in jail in Canada, and they must wire money. And the list goes on and on, Jim.
I've seen these. In fact, I always laugh at them because I get these emails myself where they want to wire transfer large funds for my entrusted care, but they want a bank account that I need to get the money to them. It's amazing that people fall for this, but you know, Ron, they do.
They do, and they are experts, and they're fabulously great salespeople on the phone. And you know, especially when a senior who's living alone, either they just lost a spouse after 30, 40, 50, 60 years, 70 years of marriage, or they're living alone for a period of time where they become very vulnerable to somebody who becomes, quote, their friend and confidant. And the people that are listening, it doesn't have to be someone who's got dementia or Alzheimer's. Your father or mother can fall victim to this, and they can be out there on a day-to-day basis with all their facilities, capacity to form daily functions. But somebody has befriended them, and then all of a sudden there's a trust factor, and all of a sudden that money is being wired out. You know, it's like a double-edged sword so many times, because I say you got to have family members involved, and then we got to make sure that the family members aren't the ones perpetrating the crime. But assuming that we have a loving family, there's so many, I'm trying more and more to get, whether we hire a private fiduciary to take on the third-party administrations of one's accounts, or the family can see the inflow and outflow of mom and dad's money, can be very important. Because even though bank tellers are supposedly what we call mandated reporters, so much of it doesn't get reported, or the bank teller doesn't see that, what's going on. So again, there's software out there now where a son or a daughter could monitor, not so much write checks or, you know, things like that, but they could see, they would get notified if there's any outflow of cash greater than, let's say, $1,000, they would get notified, almost like a life alert situation.
You know, you bring up an interesting point about sometimes seniors may be embarrassed in the situation with a widow talking to the children. The mother was just embarrassed in terms of some of the decisions that were made that basically she was talked into by two of her sons. And so she was embarrassed. As a result, it just got buried under the carpet. Now it's become a full-blown crisis.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, again, as here I'm in Southern California, in California, I'm a large supporter of either a bank trust officer or what we call a third party financial private fiduciary that is taking over third party administration. And it's just, we got to get the children out of the loop sometimes to make it work. And you know, one of the biggest ones right now, given that we're quoting on April 15th, that the IRS does not call you. And it's not just happening to seniors, it's happening to all of us. But so many seniors are getting called, this is the IRS, we have an issue where your taxes didn't get paid properly, you must wire money today to accept the thing. And that is running just wild right now.
You know, you brought up something that I've been in this business over 3 decades. And when we set up living trust, you know, husband and wife were usually the trustees of their own trust, and then we would use family members as successor trustees, especially if mom was alone. But I'll tell you, Ron, the amount of elder abuse I've seen from children with surviving spouses now, I'm a big proponent of corporate trustees, not only to protect a surviving spouse, but also to keep peace in the family among sibling rivalry. You may have in-laws, son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws. You know, I've seen stuff in the last 20 years I've never seen before.
Well, one of the things, as I say, the way I make a living is through, you know, people need to sell or buy real estate. And one of the first thing calls I get when I'm in one of these situations where, you know, someone has passed away and there's sibling rivalry is, Ron, get out there, change the locks today, because the house will be pilfered very fast by these children rivalries. And it's obviously a very sad thing to see, but it does happen. And I try to educate seniors that you love your children. Yes, we love our children, but the best thing you can do for them is to take that responsibility away from them. It's an impossible job to be a successor trustee and be in a win-win situation if you've got siblings. It's just, there's no way. When there's money, or it doesn't even have to be money, it's personal items. Mom always wanted me to have the teddy bear. Mom always wanted me to have the blanket, whatever that case may be. And that starts off World War III because the two siblings are like, when I was young, you didn't treat me very nice. And now here's my opportunity to get back at you. And it happens every day.
Yeah, in the case of the widow I was telling you, the jewelry's all gone.
Right.
Certain pieces of art, a couple pieces I understand were valuable, they're gone. I mean, it's amazing what you see happen in this area. Let's talk about corporate trusteeships, because one of the things that you know, Ron, it's not only there to keep peace in the family, but when somebody passes away, and especially the final spouse, you have income tax returns to prepare. You have, in some cases, a 706 estate tax return. There may be gifting issues that are involved. And in many cases, you're in a situation where, let's say the husband passes away first. He was the main breadwinner. He made the financial decisions. And all of a sudden, the surviving spouse is left with this money.
Right.
All kinds of complications. It is well worth to protect children and spouse of having a corporate trustee. There's less likelihood you're going to see elder abuse.
Very much so. And, a good estate plan, there's financial decisions and there's health directives. And the health directives, when I say does the person who controls the health directive also control the money, that can be a very large conflict of interest. So, yes, corporate trustee, they'll handle the money side of it, and maybe someone within your family should be in charge of health care directives. So you have a balance of power, so to speak. So I agree with you 1,000%. Interview third-party people and make it a family. Everybody sweeps this whole issue under the rug. It's not so much even death, Jim. It's incapacity. Most likely, a senior is going to be dealt at a certain time in their life with incapacity. And when the keys are taken away, who's in charge? And I just kind of drill that through their concept of who do you want there when the keys are taken away? And who's going to be in charge? And who's going to take care of these life decisions? And don't put that on your son or daughter who's living in 3,000 miles away, who's got three kids, who's got a job that requires 80 hours a week of work. Not a good idea.
Yeah, and this is an issue too, especially when parents name children as successor trustee. There's always the issue of conflicts of interest. There's the elder abuse. There's sibling rivalry. But also just the practicality, Ron, as you know, children move. Mom and dad may be living in California and the kids are scattered all over the country.
Yeah, and then you have, not so much on the abuse side, but just when they name three of their children as co-trustees, I can assure you that is not a good idea. And the attorney, you really want to get the attorney that does the listening and the advising, not just there to press the print document on an estate plan, because it really has to be case, what is your wishes? What are your goals and dreams and hopes for your life estate? And to get people to brush it off the shelf. They did it 10 years ago. They put it high up on the shelf. They couldn't even tell you who the attorney was who did it. But it's a living, breathing document. And every couple of years, it needs to be brought back to life and updated because things change. And again, if somebody has a fabulous estate plan signed, sealed, and delivered, and they feel confident about it, the idea of elder abuse is lessened because they know they've got their ducks in a row and they have trusted advisors who they can call for advice. So I really encourage that. And that's one of the things that we try to teach people is if you're confident and comfortable with your estate plan, you're less likely to fall prey. That's true.
Yeah, and not to mention the fact, you just take a look at estate planning laws. They changed. There was all the uncertainty around 2010 regarding what the estate taxes rate was going to be, what the exemption was going to be.
Right.
And there are a lot of trusts out there now with the exemption at $5,450,000. They're really invalid given the assets of the estate. So, it's just like we know health-wise, Ron, we're supposed to get an annual checkup, see our doctor, you get your blood test and find out what kind of shape you are. It's amazing when it comes to finances. Most people, I guess maybe it's the unpleasant thought of death or thinking of one's demise that, you don't think about, well, we had our wills done, we had our trust done, we did that a decade ago. They don't think about refreshing those. In terms of health conditions may have changed, financial conditions may have changed, or even family dynamics.
Well, the old saying, one thing we know, one thing that's constant is change. And I've seen it, you know, because I've been part of these discussions. I'm not an attorney, but I've been part of it at the coffee table or the dining room table with the family, with the attorney, having these discussions, because obviously real estate is part of the equation. And once everybody gets it out in the open and can talk about it freely, it really is this huge burden off their shoulders that, oh, I feel great about what I've decided about my family, and I'm going to give things away while I'm alive, gifting while I'm alive, so that I don't have to wait until I pass away to let my kids, grandchildren, great-grandchildren enjoy the fruits of my labor. And it's just, it's this whole family dynamics that if people can just, you know, I know it's easier said than done, but yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's got to be a more open and above board discussion, because everything's going to happen. It doesn't matter. We don't know when.
Let me ask you, Ron, in your own journey, how you came across this. I mean, I'm involved in financial planning, and I've seen these dynamics change over the decades. We didn't even think about elder abuse, or you ran across it rarely. I would say in the 80s, I saw a little bit more in the 90s. But boy, I tell you, I see a lot of it now, which is really surprising. And I don't know if that's a reflection of how our culture has changed, the economic circumstances of our economy today, having gone through the Great Recession. But how did you get involved?
Kind of put that into a short capsule. I was in the mortgage industry for many, many years and then transitioned over to the real estate side, and was fortunate enough to meet some very great and influential people who said, Ron, you know, from a business side, the tsunami of the aging population is going to create a market for seniors having to either stay or go. And that's what Patty Berkey, my business partner, and I have trademarked, is senior stay or go. So strictly from a business side, like, you know, most great inventions, so to speak, there's a need. And then once I got delved into it and researched it and talked to hundreds and hundreds of people and went to many, many networking events and many, many lectures on this tsunami of seniors, the recurring theme was the epidemic of elder abuse and the sickness of people that perpetrate this on our seniors that goes so underreported. And so, you know, I just became this fanatic, you want to say, or this advocate who then said, what can I do in my little world to educate, inform, and help people not fall prey to this? And that's what Patty and I have done, or that's what we look to do through different groups that we're involved with, is to try to get the message out there. So that's really how it all happened in a very short amount of time.
Ron, do you have a website, and is there a place that our listeners could go to find out more about this and at least keep them alert? And I guess what I'm really concerned about is when both husband and wife are in good health, they have all their faculties, the steps that they can take now to avoid the very issues that you and I are discussing here.
Well, we have one website that we have up on called endfinancialelderabuse.com, endfinancialelderabuse.com. And we posted some videos up there that just show samples of what people have fallen victim to. Like I mentioned, the foreign lottery scam, you know, within the family, and the grandmother on a jail scam. And then my business website is www.seniorstayorgo. And we try to post articles and commentary up there as to different events that are going on in San Diego, different organizations that are involved in terms of education and things like that. But if somebody's got a husband and a wife and they've got full capacity, the best thing they can do is to get their team together. And when I do my presentations and when I do my speaking presentations, I show the wheel. And the wheel consists of your wealth manager, your financial advisor, your attorney, your real estate person, your family, your church, your synagogue. All of these people that circle you, you know, can we put them all together and get you on the right path to understand what it's all about going forward in terms of as you age in place, as you start to lose some capacity, is everything there set and ready for you? I mean, do you want to stay at your home? Do you want your children bathing you when become incapacitated? I mean, that's something that people need to think about. Who's going to be there to take care of you, and how do you want to be taken care of? That's a big thing. What's important to you as an individual? What kind of music do you like? You know, if you were in a hospice situation, how do you want to be treated? How do you want to be handled? And it's not an easy discussion, but it's a necessary discussion.
Let's talk about a situation where there is obvious elder abuse taking place. What are the remedies a person can take? Are there government agencies that get involved here? Are there things that you can bring to bear?
Yes, if somebody suspects elder abuse, and again, I'm speaking on in San Diego, two things. You should definitely call the police department in your community for what we call a wellness check, and that starts the ball rolling and starts to create some type of documentation, you know, paper trail, so to speak. And then you can call the Adult Protective Services, and I apologize, I don't have their 800 number in front of me, but Adult Protective Services, you can call them. The issue may be with Adult Protective Services is the time to get through to them on the phone and to get them out there. But certainly you can call the police for a wellness check and talk to neighbors and just kind of feel for what's going on in the community. Again, they have no legal authority, but you can start to put the pieces of the puzzle together.
You know, you bring up a very important point because Nellie, in this case, obviously the woman had been suffering from dementia and also Alzheimer's. So a lot of her decision-making capacity, I think in this case, two of her children were taking advantage of that. So she was making decisions where she wasn't really thinking clearly.
Right.
For example, putting mortgages on her home and a reverse mortgage with the money being given to these particular sons of hers at the expense of the other children. If one suspects, well, let's just take a family dynamic like the case I just discussed, where the other children suspect some form of abuse or something that is untoward being done in the case of a parent, what should they do? I mean, do you need to bring in this case, an attorney, a district attorney? I mean, what should be done?
Well, that's a criminal side. There's civil and criminal. So, yes, I mean, again, in San Diego, we have an amazing individual. His name is Paul Greenwood, and he's our deputy district attorney here in San Diego County. And his total focus is to prosecute elder crimes. And so if you do suspect, and again, he's very accessible, and again, you can leave a message for him and he'll get back to you. So if you do suspect anything, he would be that call to make. Again, but it's about, like anything else, it's an evidence accumulation. If you suspect something versus know something, what can we do? So what people do is, again, they try to find, if they can go to the bank, really can't tell them any information because of the privacy laws today. So again, a wellness check from the police department is a good one. Hiring, you know, again, it's just a matter of you're going to try to get conservatorship of the individual. What evidence do you have that would warrant that? So it's like anything else, it can get ugly. And again, a quick story. I had a situation where the father divorced his wife very late in life and was kind of estranged from the family, bought himself a condominium here in San Diego County. So his children were not really involved with his life as he aged. And unbeknownst to the children, the father started to lose a little bit of capacity, brought in a caregiver, not through an agency, but just literally off the streets. And this caregiver was in cahoots with a bank teller. Mm. So think about that one. And it's actually being prosecuted right now, and it's starting to go public with this. But anyway, the long story short is that this collaboration resulted in hundreds of thousands of dollars of loss. Plus, he was being abused physically to be quiet. And by the time the children, I mean, this was a drug, you know, the house was being run as a drug ring in San Diego. Mm. And by the time the children got involved, obviously way too late, but the father was so conditioned by the caregiver that he was the good guy that it took really the children going to court to get him away from giving everything over to the caregiver. And so it was total mind manipulation. So that's another problem, is when somebody falls victim, just like you hear about when people become prisoners of war and things like that, the mind games that happen is the perpetrator of the crime becomes the good guy in the victim's mind or eyes. And that's a big problem as well. So the earlier you can catch it, the better. So it's really keeping a watchful eye on things and trying to be there constantly.
In this situation, let me throw another one, because I've seen this come to my attention where you have, let's say, a surviving spouse, you know, husband or wife.
Right.
And they have the beginning signs of dementia or Alzheimer. You happen to be a neighbor, good friend, and you sense there's elder abuse. But once again, you're not privy to everything, but you suspect that. Is there anything that could be done there?
Unfortunately, I've called APS probably 6 or 7 times myself just to get a paper trail going. But the combination of Adult Protective Services, APS, and the wellness check, so that you have a paper trail that, you know, again, if family members or the police or the district attorney or someone who can really go in there and take charge of the situation, that there's a paper trail and there's a history to it. Otherwise, unfortunately, you know, self-neglect is a hard thing to overcome. And if somebody's in control of their trust, or somebody's in control of, and somebody refuses to give up the authority to be the trustee of their trust or of themselves, very hard to do. It's a very difficult situation. So again, it's all a matter of trying to prevent it before it goes there. And that's what the whole awareness thing, what we're trying to do is stop it in its tracks before it becomes a cancer. And it's a hard process. It's a hard one to do.
So, Ron, if we were to sum up here for our listeners, things that people can do to head off these kind of things from ever happening, one would be to have an up-to-date current estate plan so you know that everything's in order, you have medical directives. Secondly, think of having a corporate trustee that comes into play on the death of one spouse so that you have somebody that is a mediator, somebody that's knowledgeable of tax laws, the investment markets, so that you can make sure that that spouse is taken care of. Other things that you can do is just, once again, be fully aware, and especially if you have, for example, errant children, or you're aware of that there's sibling rivalry, recognizing these conditions existing beforehand and taking measures to correct that is one way to avoid all the things we're talking about here.
Yeah, you got it right on. As I say, I try to advocate more. Don't wait till there's a crisis. That's what, unfortunately, too many people do. They wait till the crisis and everybody's scrambling. Set all this up. I mean, you can resign as a trustee of your trust at any time and have a third party administer it. So if you are at the point of time where it's just an overwhelming task to keep up your checking account and handle all the charitable contributions you wish to make, you don't have to wait at one day and before you can be a co-trustee with a bank type of situation. So there's a lot of options where, like anything else, you know, we spend so much time investigating what car we drive and what house we want and what food we eat. I wish people would take that same amount of time in terms of what's my quality of life. I want the best and highest quality of life. And if I can get that through, you're not giving up control, but by sharing control with those who have your best interests at heart, it's going to be a much better deal. And that's really my pitch in terms of quality of life.
Okay, Ron, as we close, sum up again some sources or websites where our listeners can go to and get more information about this and find out ways that they can deal with it.
Yeah, it's endfinancialelderabuse.com, seniorstayorgo.com. And if they have any questions from there, I can direct them to all different sources in San Diego County. We have tremendous charitable organizations that can help people out and counseling services that are free. And so any questions they may have of who and what to talk to, it's no charge for my time to talk to someone, just to direct them to various places to go and get an idea of who they should talk to.
And at the national level, what could they do?
The national level, that's a little tougher one for me to answer. Again, if they suspect anything, it's Adult Protective Services. I mean, every county has Adult Protective Services. They should have a district attorney's office if you suspect anything. So it's much more of a local problem than it is in terms of trying to get solutions to it, in terms of if you suspect anything, because it's really on the local level that you're going to get results in terms of a police action or something like that.
Well, listen, Ron, thanks once again for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Once again, very important issue, and appreciate the good work you're doing.
Thank you. Have a great day out there.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Income. Once again, you know, the issues that we're talking about here, elder abuse, is becoming more common. please, if you can, take steps, especially between a husband and wife. There's so many things you can do to avoid having this happen, having a corporate trustee, having your estate plan up to date. And even if issues do come up, you know, there's remedial action that you can take, as he talked about with the district attorney, and there are various things that you have at the state and local level. But an issue that is really a sign of our times. We're seeing this much more. It's becoming much more prevalent. At least a few people are talking about it. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.